Hi, I'm Stargate Pioneer.
And I'm Steven Jondrew, and we're from Better Podcasting, a proud member of the Gunna Geek Network.
Just like the show you're listening to now.
The opinions expressed are those of the individual host.
Check out all the other podcasts at GunnaGeekNetwork.com.
And get ready, because geekiness begins in 3, 2, 1.
This is Gemma Redgrave, and you're listening to Gallifrey Public Radio.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussion ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Witten. Did you just say womp womp? And my co-host, Haley Malley.
I like it with the helmet on.
And Keir Hansen.
And that's why, to this day, I can't eat cotton candy.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But don't worry, if we get into anything too serious, we'll warn you again.
Welcome to episode 209 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we're a little late getting to the studio because first the roads were just a complete mess with this weird vegan pasta all over the place, and then everyone in the house was busy having these argumentative hug sessions with the dead everywhere you turn. You know, I swear, 2016 just gets weirder and weirder, you know? I am your host. My name is Keir, and joining me in the GPR studios this evening is my evil, not quite undead cohort, Haley Malley. Haley, how you doing?
Mostly alive.
Mostly alive. Just no hugs. No touching.
No touching. No.
What's going on this week?
Well, we tighten the straps on our spoiler helmets once again and look deeply at the emotional baggage our unlucky bunch of Coal Hill students carry in the third installment of class titled Night Visiting. From confrontations with deceased family to kids being thrown out of their homes for sexual identity to realizations of new friendships in the making, it's an intense episode in many respects. But does it all work out in the end?
Yeah, so there is a lot going on in this episode, and Ness is definitely not letting up on the emotional gas pedal, so to speak. This is, again, I think kind of a continuation of the previous episodes. Really intensive immersion into the lives and hearts of these kids. And what better way to do that than to really delve into how they deal with loss and mourning? Because they're apparently going to be losing a lot of people on a regular basis on this show. What was your sort of general take on it?
I think this is probably my least favorite so far of the season. It doesn't make it a bad episode. It's obviously not as much fun as some of the other episodes were.
Mm. Yeah, it definitely was not trying for fun factor
at
all. I mean, even like little Quill moments had a lot of bite.
She's the best.
She remains the best.
Yes.
I did see someone make mention of the fact that the whole idea of, obviously, our primary plot line here in dealing with this Lankan alien species that uses the faces of the dead as its lure. Apparently was also used in a Buffy episode. So there was, I think they said it was season 7 is an episode called The First.
Actually, it's kind of an ongoing villain that first appears, I believe, in season 3 and then is the big bad in season 7.
Gotcha.
It's more of a ghost-like creature, though, in Buffy, and it's just used to manipulate people to do what you want them to do.
Okay. Well, I think in this particular case, I mean, you take it from the title down. I mean, we're dealing with something where there's this whole reference to this folk song, which really isn't, it's not an oldie-timey folk song. For anyone that wants to know, go ahead and look it up. It's back from 2006, so we're not
ye
really
oldie times of 2006.
Yeah, you know, back when they used, you know, instruments that were acoustical and types. But so it sets this very particular tone for the episode that sort of runs through April's music. It runs through Ram still dealing with his grieving, and obviously it really centers upon Tanya and her family, you know, from that very kind of really jarring open.
You know. You knew when you saw that happy of an opening, it was going to be a dark and twisted episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You gotta climb to the top of the ladder before you can jump off the diving board. In terms of that, in terms of just that that idea of that threat, you know, slowly grabbing a hold of all these individuals, not killing them. Because apparently, you know, we find at our resolution point, nobody's dead, but they've been they're being added to the energy. It's just, I guess, in a very Weeping Angels like way, it sort of feeds off that aspect of it without killing its victim. It has something it needs to draw from them. I think eventually they'd probably, you know, they'd starve them out and then move on to the next one. But since they resolve all this in a matter of an evening, well done you. You know, I guess there's no loss. So when these things disappear, everybody can, as is typical, brush themselves off and say, oh, that's funny, a little bit of lost time. I'm going to be late to class. Yeah.
This is also a very Buffy element that this show has, where the general townspeople are completely oblivious to what's going on around them. Oh, we've got a lot of, you know, corpses that show up with puncture wounds in the neck. I don't know what that could be.
Well, I think, though, as far as just the forcing these kids to see the scale, this is one of the better opportunities to have the threat that really takes place well outside the school grounds. Mm-hmm. Granted, the Shadowkin in the first episode were sort of following the kids around, sort of attacking them within their homes, but this is something where it's really starting to feed on the masses. And so it has that better, you know, that larger scope to it. The kids clearly aren't seasoned enough yet to be able to recognize the gravity of this stuff on that scale. I mean, I would think that the panic levels seeing things at this scale would rattle them a bit more than they do. But I think they're still reeling from from their eyes opening to this greater possibility. I think, is it Ram the one that says that, you know, first I got to deal with these, you know, killer shadows, and then I got, you know, I got to worry about deadly ink.
This isn't even the third weirdest thing I've seen this month.
So they're slowly starting to come to terms with this, but I don't think, you know, it hasn't jaded them in any way.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, in this one in particular, by the time they figured out what's going on, they've pretty much got the problem solved. Like, you know, there wasn't a lot of time to feel dire threat. Because it's like they figure it out and then, oh, bus, boom, fine, problem solved.
Right, yeah. And I guess that's a nice sort of workaround on Quill's behalf. That she can't technically, like, take a weapon to someone.
This isn't a weapon, it's a vehicle. Smash. Yeah.
And she probably doesn't think she's going to kill it. She's just putting it in check, so it's not technically killing. So, but I guess, as a result of having a threat or a villain that is there to really sort of tear everything down, sort of get at you emotionally, that works very well for Ness's agenda in getting us really invested in these characters by stripping everything else away. He needs to give us a plot line. He needs to keep the action moving and so forth, you know, as is expected, but he really, really, I think, has an agenda to get viewers to understand, if not care about, at least understand the driving forces behind some of these kids and why they happen to kind of gravitate towards one another. You know, no such thing as coincidences. I want to save Tanya for a little bit because I think that's just a really interesting, you know, piece that they did. But one of the sort of the outliers as far as this emotional journey that we continue to follow, because it wasn't genuinely affected by the Lankin threat, was Charlie and Mateus. So their relationship is on a speed course as far as the viewing audience. And I want to say I was kind of surprised, not put off or anything of that sort, but just genuinely surprised at for what we've continually we question the YA label on this show, what the real target demographic is as far as the nature of the you know, the bedroom scenes and stuff. I mean, granted, there's nothing graphic or anything, but it's clear enough that it doesn't matter, you know, what the nature of the coupling is, but it's a bit much for teenagers, you know.
I don't really think it is. I think it's probably right on par for teenagers today.
Okay.
So I think, and teenagers have always been like, ooh, it's risque in watching this kind of show. And it's just, you know, they hope their parents don't recognize what they're watching.
Okay. So it would make for a very uncomfortable.
Yeah, it's not sit down with your parents and watch it. No, no. It's like, I don't watch Game of Thrones with my parents now. So.
Yeah. Wiggle the sausage. Wiggle the sausage. But no, but I think in general, as long as I just put the YA label aside, or if I just recognize that YA in this case is riding towards like late teens, mm-hmm. you know, as opposed to anyone who would think it's, oh, 13, 14, 15. I don't know. This episode might have gone a little beyond what I would be comfortable with 13 or 14 year olds viewing.
Mm-hmm. And there's another thing. Some of the references they're making, like all the Buffy references, which I get, but mm-hmm. a teenager is not probably going to get those because teenagers now probably aren't watching a lot of Buffy. That's a show that was on the air 15 years ago.
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, what audience are they targeting? I think they probably are targeting older teenagers, you know, high schoolers and into college. That is probably the group they're really going after. And then, you know, any other older Doctor Who fans they can pull in as well with that.
Okay. Yeah, I'll have to see whether Ness starts to speak a little bit more about this. I think they're in their final production block right now. So once they sort of wrap for the first season, maybe he'll be able to discuss things more on a sort of a meta level about what their initiatives and what their intents really are going forward as they hopefully get optioned for season two. Another little piece that we get here, in addition to, and I did, by the way, I found it very interesting the fact that they couldn't materialize on, or the Langan could not lock in on Charlie's parents consistently in order to sort of visualize them. I thought for a split second that he just sort of interrupted, like paid attention to them while they were still forming. But the fact that the Langan was expecting everyone there to be human, that it wasn't able to sort of figure out his mechanics, I guess.
But they got Quill.
But they got Quill. So maybe stretching himself too thin trying to do two at once?
Here's what I'm thinking. Maybe it's he knows where his parents' souls are because he's got that box. So he wouldn't buy into the this is your parent's soul.
Okay. Okay. You can't be there. You're there in the cabinet.
No, you're under my bed. I've got a box and everything.
That's my nightlight in the bedroom that we've been necking and making mookie to the last 30 minutes. Yes, I just said making mookie.
Yep. So what the kids are saying these days, right?
Let's just get to Miss Quill because I think the whole showdown with her ghost sister, whether or not there was any accuracy, I mean, just how much of it she really knew, you know, she's whole manipulating, I had to just call this Wolverine out or whatever she was, however she was referring to it, was another great Quill exchange. And I think it's fantastic to know not only some of their like trial by combat, their family nest thing, you know, every sibling tries to kill each other. It's what we do. But even while she was testing the validity of who was standing in front of her, she never let up on that sardonic, just dripping acid persona all the time. It never ends. It's perfect.
It is. She is the best part of this show right now, really. Got all these stupid teenagers in my show about Miss Quill.
Just get them all out of the way. It's going to be the spinoff of the spinoff, the Quill show.
No, it's my new buddy cop drama, Missy and Quill.
Oh my God. That is the actual antagonist as your protagonist, and just do-gooder kids get in the way the entire time. It's just them trying to destroy everyone, and they get foiled week after week
by these meddling kids.
Yeah, so the heroes keep changing, but your villains remain the same. I love this concept. But I think as far as having to recruit Charlie and Mateus in the process was sort of an interesting little connection. It wasn't a matter of she didn't necessarily need them other than just to sort of break the cycle of conversation because she didn't want to walk away from this thing. So she asks him for weapons. And you get a screwdriver, but not even the good kind.
It's like he doesn't like knives, but he still brings things that she can obviously torture this creature with.
Yeah.
So yeah. It's just a little silly.
This is, well, that's what it's just going to be. It's going to be her wanting to be as absolutely violent and militant as her sentence will allow, and her getting thwarted by the fact that she's dealing with these, you know, ridiculously rational humans and Charlie, the alien pacifist. Now,
who hasn't ruled out genocide?
Not entirely. It's still stacking up the odds. We also get a little deeper. It seemed kind of rushed, but I understand why it was done. Obviously, it kind of ties a lot of the episode. It's one of those sort of those last minute buttons that gets thrown in there for April's relationship with her missing or sort of estranged father. The dealing with the parental alcoholism and the absentee father and those things in it. I get the point that it brings her and Ram together very quickly, but I think as far as the dialogue sequence goes, I think it's very effective. I didn't feel like it was. I thought the moment seemed rushed that it showed up within the waning minutes of the episode. But as far as the scene itself and the way that it pulled the two characters together, a lot of times you see, I'll just say, The Flash, where a character comes in and says something, all hell's breaking loose and everyone's an emotional wreck and people are just, just preparing for disaster. And someone comes in and gives one speech, and not even a speech, just says something like, "Come on, I believe in you, Iris," and yep, Everything's fine. This had none of those hints. I mean, or none of those aspects to me personally. I think everything that April was bringing to the table was paced and the wording was chosen so that it was just what she wanted to reveal. Mm-hmm. And Ram didn't take it as I completely understand where you're coming from. Let's be chummy. And by the way, let's snog. It had more of a, it was given enough time to sort of sink in, register. His responses were a little more genuine, that I'm really sorry to hear all this. I feel for you, but I don't want to overstep my bounds. And she draws him closer. So I think that felt a lot more genuine to me.
Mm-hmm. Something I think they've done a good job of with this show is they've kind of set this pattern or trend of each episode is really focused on a specific character, this one, Tanya mostly, but still giving all the other characters enough that their character is developed by this episode as well. So, we get more of Ram being through the ringer because that's his arc for the series. But, we also get the development of Charlie and Mateus's relationship. We get more information about Quill's backstory. And we get this about April, not only a development of a new relationship for her and the backstory about her father, but also, like she said, she's not made of glass, which is something that hadn't really been shown up to this point in the series.
No, there was just sort of a line reference to it about, it was back in the first episode where she said, don't equate, it wasn't kindness for weakness.
It was
don't
niceness.
Don't confuse being nice.
Soft, I think.
Being soft or weak, yeah. Which is a great adage. I mean, it gets used quite often, but it's something where she can say it, but you still look at her and you're like, yeah, but you're super sweet. And you've survived a lot, but you're not exactly kind of take charge just yet. She hasn't had her back against the wall to really show. She gets to the point where she's willing to kind of drive the spike through her chest in that first episode to finish off the Shadowkin, and that was like, okay, well that's you standing up, putting your life on the line. I'm waiting to see whether she gets pushed to some point where she has to really take the offensive and start attacking people, things. Other than just sort of hacking at vines. They're not vines. They're alien tentacles.
They're umbilical roots.
Blech. Okay. So speaking of icky, pulsy umbilical roots. So obviously the main trunk of this thing as it travels out of the rift or the tear or whatever they're going to call it in this show. I guess they're not going to call it the rift because that was Torchwood's thing.
It's the bunghole of time.
The bunghole of time. Okay. Yep. Hasn't been used since that episode yet.
I'm ever going to call it.
I don't know if they've discarded it. But it is obviously what runs to Tanya and her this long, very painful conversation with her not father, with the noisiest blinks in the world. I was still trying to figure out the blinks, like down to the final moments. But
I think it was just another thing so that when you weren't seeing the root thing come out of his back, it was still, this is alien.
Yeah,
this is
in case you forgot.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I'm really surprised. I'm impressed by the Lankin as a, you know, as a villain, because it's something that literally, I mean, it had every detail. I mean, she kept quizzing it over and over and over. And the only thing that it did not get right was how she harbors her mourning, whether it's a feeling of loss or a feeling of anger. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it's downfall at the end of it all. I didn't even feel, I think in any other instance, with that kind of all of that buildup and then her taking its hand and imbuing her anger over her father's loss into the creature and it acting as poison. I think in any other show or in any other setup, I would have pushed back and said, that's ridiculous. That's like saying that I'm going to fight off the Cybermen with love. Oops. And who would do that, really? But it somehow this went right past me, and I said, okay, I get it. In fact, I think I even started to kind of pick up on it before she had to give the exposition and explain what she had just done. I don't know. Did that sit all right with you?
The first time I watched it, I like you, it didn't push me out or anything. But the second time I watched it, it kind of brought up the same problems that the Cyberbrig did in the last episode of the series. And okay. That is that she can't be the only one who has anger mixed with her grief. And
okay.
There should be other people who have, you know, the greater amount of anger than grief at any given moment that that thing is going to pick up on.
Unless, well, yeah, I guess you're kind of playing the odds. The only thing I think is, because it had such a long conversation with her, I mean, it was...
Oh, so it only puts out the hand when it thinks it's going to win?
Right. So if everybody else that it has claimed, it was able to break down very quickly or get a sense of, ugh, I'm not going to touch you. You've got a hell of a lot of issues going on. You're probably going to be bad feed. I'm moving on to the next house. Because it didn't have everybody. I mean, you see it running through the streets. And it's like every third window has a tentacle hanging out of it. So maybe some folks are just are not worth feeding on. Or they've reached their closure, so there isn't anything to feed off of, anger or otherwise. There isn't that pain that it was looking for, or the, you know, that loss, the whatever it was really capturing that was its sustenance. So, yeah, I'd imagine some folks when it, you know, shows up as your whatever your weird uncle, you know, like, you're the one who used to give me swirlies when I was 8. I hated your guts. And, oh, okay, next house. Whoo. My uncle never gave me swirlies. I didn't pull that out of anywhere. I was just improvising. Really, my uncle is a lovely man. He doesn't even know how to turn his computer on. He can't listen to podcasts.
I don't know if my uncle owns a computer.
But overall, I mean, sort of thematically and in terms of the tone of the episode, this was I think a deepening of what we just got in the last episode. It slowed the pace down again. Spent more time really digging into the hearts and minds of our characters, and just sort of picked up the energy as needed just to get us, sort of propel us from one tier to the next. You know, oh, we need to figure out exactly what, you know, what this thing is and what it feeds upon. Okay, Quill does, bup, 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 bup. That moves us to the next bump. You know, Ram and April need to find out, you know, where the source of this thing is or where it's strongest so they know where to attack. So they go running through the streets and they finally get in touch or they track at April's house. Bum, bum, bum. And obviously bring Quill along so that she can steal a bus. Where does she get these things? Ah, she's resourceful that way.
Running through the streets was a nice change to running through the hallways.
Yeah, they're going to have to do that every once in a while. Yep. Hooray for night shoots. any other moments that really kind of stood out for you and just said, okay, well, you know, whether or not it was directly related to the episode, that was a nice piece.
Well, Quill reading the Hunger Games was rather fantastic.
Nice. Yes, that was a great product placement. Did this really happen?
At the very end, where they're all like hanging out together and high-fiving and celebrating their victory again, and Quill is off by herself. And that's not the first time we've seen it. I don't think it'll be the last. Where they're all coming together as a group, and she is still very much the outsider and not part of that. We saw that last week with, you know, her and her robot situation, and still being, she's not part of the group.
Yeah. I wonder if we're ever going to get occasional reminders of what their real appearance is again.
We have not even actually gotten their real appearance. We got what April thinks they might really look like.
That's true. Everything through April vision.
Yeah.
Huh. Okay. Yeah. I'll have to that might be another piece that they can continue to play with if they want to.
Well, and I think they're probably going to want to establish their humanity as much as they can before they remind us how alien they actually are.
I think at this point, well, depending on how far we go, and again, this sort of gets us into hypothesizing for down the road, and we do have a ways to go. This is only episode 3, and we've got a lot that we're already chewing on. I mean, you think about all the plates that are currently spinning right now. So you got Charlie in the Cabinet, which is like a real weird Roald Dahl title right there. Charlie in the Soul Cabinet. It's the follow-up to Charlie in the Chocolate Factory. You've got April. Something's going to be happening with April and her mom. This is going to be like, you know, the Buffy and Buffy's mom kind of relationship. So far, Ram's dad is the only one who realizes that something larger is going on, right? Mm-hmm. He's the only one who's been tipped off. Tanya's mother's never going to get it. She's going to refuse to see it. Although I'm so glad that they had a moment towards the end. I mean, granted, obviously, you know, anniversaries of bereavement are pretty tightening moments for a lot of families, but she's always had such a hard edge to her, so demanding and so quick to come crashing down on Tanya that the fact that they can, you know, have moments of laughing and recalling stories and things like that and have the, you know, the kiss goodnight kind of things. I think we're going to need that a little bit. She can't stay. Only Quill is allowed to stay that acidic throughout. yeah. And then obviously, you know, I think the Charlie and Mateus relationship as well, as far as, is Mateus just going to just leave his home forever? You know, Charlie says you're free to stay here as long as you want. You know, are the police going to come looking for him?
I hope they come up with some more character development for Mateus, because up to this point, he's very much just kind of been the love interest. Like, we got a little bit about his parents, but not really much about him.
Yeah, and I don't want him to be painted as not being particularly bright, because at times they, like, give him sort of the, it's the foreign kid persona. And he just finds things unusual or difficult to comprehend.
He's
and
kind
maybe
of the Xander.
A little bit, but Xander was goofy. Mateus isn't goofy, I don't think, in the slightest. I think it's just a matter of there's a triangle of culture clashes. You've got Mateus in his Central European background and his you know, adaptive English. You've got the rest of the human kids that he interacts with, so he's trying to fit in with, you know, with them on a social level. And there's Charlie, who's pretending to be both these things and not necessarily that adept at either. So he's like the foreign kid who's really the foreign kid, really foreign. So yeah, I think they're going to have to, I'm hoping that Mateus isn't going to be a second string character throughout. Mm. Although he's kind of lumped in that way right now.
Yeah. I mean, they left him out of the second episode entirely.
Right. Yeah.
He was barely in the first episode outside of the dance.
So sort of Rory mid-season 5.
Yeah. Yeah. That would probably be a good analogy.
Or even Mickey mid-season 1.
Aw.
Yeah. Well, that's good, because that means he's going to become like kick-ass by the end of the season.
I'm worried he's going to be like the sacrificial lamb.
Oh, no.
Season
1. No, there will be riots. There is so much as far as the Charlie and Mateus relationship. And by the way, it's so funny. I don't know if you follow Patrick Ness's Twitter, but he just said, you know, it's great to see all these kids who've been coming out. They've been asking me these questions about the nature of what I put into writing for Charlie and Mateus and everything. Oh, and by the way, this is like, he goes through like 8 or 9 of these tweets. One morning, he was just sort of tearing into it the way he does. And he said, just want to let people know that there's no little shortened name for the Charlie and Mateus ship. It's Charlie and Mateus.
That's what he thinks.
Well, no, and his point for it, I think, was one of the best things I've heard expressed. He said, as far as the whole, you know, I become part of you and you become part of me and our names meld kind of thing. And he said, if you have to give up something of yourself to be with someone else, that's not love. Mm-hmm. So it's the whole idea of, you know, the sum can be greater than the two parts, but both parts are present. mm-hmm. in there without diminishing anything. So he phrased it a lot more eloquently in 140 characters than I can able to do for rambling for 30 seconds. But go back and follow Patrick Ness on Twitter and read it himself, and then thank him for being awesome. But all in all, we've got a long way to go with the series, and I'm really liking where it's headed. I think we're probably due for a full-on action terror fest for a little while.
After this is a two-parter.
Yes. So is it going to be one where, well, just knowing how Who has been, Who proper has been structuring two-parters lately, mm-hmm. as far as making them extra dramatic. Mm-hmm. We could do something a little different in the format here and have something that starts out dramatic, still staying within the characters and really getting some depth. And then as soon as we get to a comfort point, all hell breaks loose for the cliffhanger and then slam through the second part of it.
Well, and not just Doctor Who, but in television in general, a mid-season two-parter is usually a big shift in a show.
Mm. Where could we possibly shift to from where we are right now? I mean, it's three episodes in and we're already nearing a mid-season. What do you do to shake things up on something that's brand new to the audience?
Well, I think up to this point, we've really been establishing characters. So the mid-season could be establishing, maybe a larger threat for the rest of the season. Or, just maybe a better defined, mission statement going forward for this group or something like that.
Okay. All right. Giving, or a reminder that of some of the plates that are spinning right now. Shadowkin has not been eradicated. They said they're going to be coming back. April is still sharing a heart. Yeah. Sucks to be you, April. Ram is still, he seems to be doing pretty well with the leg, running through the streets, doing okay. Let's see how his football game is improving.
Yeah, I don't think strength or function was really the problem. It was the agility he was having some issues with.
Yeah, a little shaky on the dismount.
Yep. All right. Not really bending it like Beckham.
No. But maybe he can make a nice alugobi, because everyone can make alugobi, but not everyone can bend it like Beckham. I love that freaking movie.
I'm gonna have to go watch it.
I'm gonna have to go watch it again.
Okay.
And then I'm gonna have to go make alugobi. Because did you ever watch it with the? We're off the rails at this point. It doesn't matter. If you watch the DVD, the special features, mm-hmm. there is an interview with the director and writer. She gets her mom on.
Yes.
And they go through a cooking class. Her mom teaches everyone how to make alugobi.
You say this like I haven't also watched all the bonus features on the DVD.
I'm sharing this for the people's at home.
They're not listening anymore. They're like, what are they talking about?
The secret is the best cardamom you can buy. Anyway, I'm not going to complain because we made moussaka tonight. So my palate for heavily seasoned foods has been sated for about another 45 minutes before I go upstairs and have another slice of it. But now I need Indian. Tomorrow is non day. It's a non day. Well, that's enough for that.
Okay.
We had an opportunity. Haley and I both got to sit down with none other than Polly herself, Annika Wills, at LI Who 4 just a couple weeks back. Wow, it's a couple weeks now. A couple weeks have gone by. Weird.
It's like a week and a half.
By the time I edit this thing, 2 weeks plus. But for you, and we were able to chat with her. We weren't even planning to speak with her. She grabbed both of us physically and wanted us to sit down. She was just in such great spirits first thing Friday morning.
And we were like, well, actually, we have another interview scheduled, but we promise we'll come back. And we had to. We couldn't leave the room.
Yeah, she's over by the door. It was endearing. And she is almost, and I'm going to say almost, because you got your work cut out for you there, Annie. She's almost as instantly lovable as Katie Manning. Mm. Almost. Like so close. Like photo finish. But yeah, so here you go. An unexpected pleasure this morning. This was not on the schedule, but I think we're going to do just fine. We have a couple of moments to sit with Annika Wills on this momentous, not only an LI Who weekend, but also on we're going to refer to here stateside as our Power of the Daleks weekend.
Oh, I like it.
Just top of everyone's minds. So thank you so much for having a couple of moments to speak with us.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
Well, we'll certainly get a chance to talk about the animated re-releases and everything that's going on here in the States, as we're getting it a little bit behind our UK friends. They're doing a theatrical simultaneous broadcast on Monday night. I believe just as we get back from this event, we'll be headed over to the theater to to watch the full episode run. You've been speaking lately about the some of the differences in what you're seeing within the program classic, or I will say the legacy of the program, versus what's airing today with Peter and working with the current company. You had the opportunity, Polly, Ben, traveling with Patrick, and being able to put something that was family approachable, but really touched upon very poignant, relevant topics for the time. Do we still have that today?
Well, no, this is a massive question. I can't, you know, right. So the thing is that if you look back at that time, what we were doing in telly then was very brilliant, actually. It was very brilliant. I mean, it was live. We were doing it live. We had these massive, great big cameras, which were very cumbersome, with wires all over the studio floor, and bits of tape that shone so that you could hit your mark. If you didn't hit your mark, you wouldn't be in the shot. The whole thing was a technological feat. And then you're doing it as for live. So, and there was a group of us actors. It was rather like a sort of repertory company in a way, that would always be chosen to fill the roles, because we could do it, because, you know, they could rely on us not to fall over or lose the plot or, you know, or forget our lines or not be able to handle it. So now, and then we have brilliant designers who are thinking like in the Power of the Daleks, where you see the pod where the Daleks come out, there are these randles on the, and Patrick and Mike and I used to love to run into the studio and say, what have they done? Let's see what the designers have done. This is so clever. Those were salad bowls stuck, silver salad bowls stuck on, you know, because that was cheap and easy to get. So the whole thing was a kind of creative, a brilliant creative. Then you have, I have to say, stories which you can understand because they have a beginning, a middle, and an end in that order. So you can follow the story. Now I will take us to now. I don't understand the stories, and I lose the plot, and I don't know what's going on anymore, and actually Foyle's War is on the other side, and it's really well made, so I think I'll watch that instead. So that's how it is for me, but I'm not a modern child, you see. So the children now, and youngsters now, and people who are watching Who now, are different people, you know, and they expect it to be very clever, and, you know. It's the same with Sherlock. I didn't get Sherlock. I was so looking forward to Sherlock. After the first 10 minutes, I don't know what's happening. I don't understand it.
We'll have to have this a word with Mr. Moffat about the pace of his writing. Well, one thing that does remain a constant throughout, as far as the audience is concerned, whether it was in the mid-60s or the mid-teens that we have now, and that's your female viewers. And Polly's representation as a very strong, very capable feminist role. What were your thoughts as far as what you felt what you were allowed or given the opportunity to bring to her character that gave her that strength? Was it something written in, or did you have to push that thread forward?
A bit of both.
Okay.
A bit of both. Polly was written by Kit Pedler. Kit Pedler was a genius, and he had this very bright and clever science wife, and she was determined that Polly would be, you know, a proactive and intelligent person. And then, again, like I'm saying about this business of the repertory actors, that they knew that if they cast me in the role, I would bring in what I could, which was me in the moment. But I must tell you that, again, we look with modern eyes. We look back to that time. You had to fight your corner, you know. It wasn't so. What was very interesting was that when they played the two episodes last week, it was just at the British Film Institute, and there's this moment when Polly says, Oh, well, I'm going to go back and tidy the room up. And Ben goes, what, what? And she said, well, somebody's got to do it. The whole audience roared with laughter. I didn't get that. Because for me, actually, I didn't feel like I wanted to, I didn't have to prove anything. I always felt, that if you're traveling with somebody as brilliant as the doctor, you would do whatever it took. And if it meant making coffee, fine, you make the coffee. Yeah, no. So I think it's very much the modern person looking back and then projecting onto our characters, you know.
Excellent. Well, I think it has definitely set a standard moving forward as well. They started introducing more and more companions that had that degree of comfort and give back.
Yes.
So,
However, I took absolute exception to when the companion struck the doctor recently. I shot off my sofa and said, "Oi, you don't do that. He's the doctor, you know."
Line in the sand. Well, now, you have had some opportunity to work with Big Finish in taking Polly's character a little further. Oh. Any plans to do some continued companion
research? Yeah, we're
research?
Going on. We're going on because they've become popular. And mm-hmm. We have got some super writers. And so in a way, Fraser and I both saying, it's a bit like the old days where you open your script and you think, now, what adventures are we going to get up to this time? I must tell you, because we record them years ahead. So there are more coming up this year. Very interesting things are happening with Polly and Ben. In the short stories and also in the ones where we do four. I mean, it's such fun. We love it. And for me, it's our characters written now. So as you were saying, now we are modern characters. Oh, we've got some really good ones. One where Michael Craze meets his dad. I'm not sure if that's out or not. The trouble is, it's not very good asking us because we do it a year before and we've forgotten. Mm-hmm. But anyway, good stories coming up. Watch this space.
All right. Well, I'm getting that signal there, so we'll make
sure.
I've got
more to say. Come back. We'll do it later.
Have you found that in doing these, you've been able to discover some new or explore some new facets and nuances of Polly? Have you found out more about her in doing this?
Oh, yes, indeed.
You personally?
Yes. Okay. Oh, yes. I mean, it when you're creating, it's never stuck. You know, you're never stuck. It always grows. All the time, and actually not so much just about me, but about Michael. Watching The Power of the Daleks last week, my God, he was a good actor. You know, when you're doing it at the time, you know that you work well, that's okay, and Patrick, you know, brilliant, absolutely wonderful, and it's fun, and you're enjoying. When you go back and you watch Michael Craze, his timing, I mean, apart from the fact that he was completely brilliantly beautiful, but his timing and what he does with the lines that he's got and the intelligence that he brings, I don't understand why he didn't become a great big flipping movie star. He should have done. He had it. He had the beauty and he had the talent.
We'll have to.
And he was my friend. He was my friend. I'm very proud of that.
Well, Annika, thank you so much for spending your time with us this morning.
Thank
Have yourself a wonderful weekend with us here in Long Island. We will be certain to raise a glass with you this evening if you're out and about for the frivolities.
Absolutely. Thanks.
All right, for news for this week, in keeping with the L.I. Who theme, because we're never going to let this thing go, because that would be like admitting that it's over.
Never.
Who's going to do that? As long as I still have photos to clean up and interviews to edit, this is never going to be over. But I got a lot of good press coverage as well. I think Newsday had something out there for it. For those of you who go ahead and follow Long Island Doctor Who on Facebook, I know Ken Deep, the showrunner, was able to share that link too. If I can find it fast enough, I'll include it with the show notes here too. But quick write-up in the Long Island Press gave a nice little synopsis of what was going on here. A quick couple of statements from Ken about the nature of inviting people into the Long Island area to enjoy everything that took place. And yeah, and it hit some of the great salient points of this particular con. And that's that, you know, the attendance is down under 2,000 people. So you get to see the same faces through the weekend, chat with everybody. If you've never met them before, you'll probably see them often enough that you'll get a chance to, they'll become sort of the visual acquaintance and you can strike up a conversation in an elevator or with the talent who happen to be traveling the elevator with you. Who did you end up? Did you get to share any elevator moments with anyone of interest?
I spent a lot of time with Paul Salamoff.
Everybody spent a lot of time with Paul Salamoff. Paul is one of our new besties. Well, we got to know Paul over the course of the last few years, but this year was fantastic because obviously he was able to help coordinate bringing along the Eighth Doctor's console from the 96 film as he brought it out from L.A. with him. So that was a huge boon to everyone who was doing the photo shoots. Yeah. So
I know you picked up a new bestie.
Yes, my new best friend and soulmate and spirit animal and tribesman, Jeremy Raddick. We will have lots of opportunity. You'll be able to hear our interviews with Jeremy both one-on-one and also when we were able to have him on the panel with Yiji So and Daphne Ashbrook talking about what they've been doing since the 96 film. So, yeah, a lot of fun. We're really glad we were able to meet Jeremy, and he's going to be, I'm sure we'll have him back on at some point down the road. So, other stuff's going on here. It's probably worth noting that... Well, that the Mirror, as a tabloid, is allowed to say what they say because every once in a while they get something right.
You know broken watch, right twice a day.
They are claiming their insiders and their special BBC sources as saying that they're already looking beyond Peter Capaldi and Pearl Mackey's tenure, which has not even begun yet, to say what's going to be happening when we start getting into the Chibnall period. And I guess their suppositions or what they're posing to people is that both of them will leave after Series 10 for a very specific lineup format. And that's the younger, dashing Doctor with a... typical kind of a Rose Tyler or Martha Jones, Jennifer Coleman kind of a youthful Earth female counterpart, so that you can wonder if there's going to be snogging in the TARDIS box, I guess. And the thing that's getting to me, the thing that's bothering me about this, is that the quote that they're trying to pull together about the fact that BBC management wants them to go back to a Tennant-like, you know, Tennant and Rose sort of pairing, is that it has to do with merchandising and specifically doing it for the kids. I don't know. That just doesn't sit well with me right now. And maybe that's just because when you get really invested in the show and you see what they've been able to do as far as the tone, the advancements, the storylines tightening up, as far as getting rid of some of the extraneous fluff, you could still have your one and done storylines and so forth, but if you really want to get into something dramatically or play a longer arc, you can do so with a lot of gravitas because you've got talent that can carry it. I don't know if they're worried about merchandising, if that's one of their prime motivators. I worry that they're missing the point, especially from the BBC, really. You know, I get the BBC Shop magazine or their catalog a couple times a year, actually pretty frequently, maybe every 2 months or so. And you look through of all the programs that they're promoting, and they always save the Doctor Who page for the last page of the catalog. That's their big 2-page spread, all of this swag. And it just goes to show that, I mean, as far as a merchandising stand, and all this stuff is stuff that I know people purchase. I see it out there in people's hands. I see it out there in people's hands that I didn't even know they were Whovians. But if that's the case, if you're out there buying adipose Christmas light strings, that has nothing to do with who's playing your Doctor. That has nothing to do with the age range of your companion.
I mean, maybe they want a Doctor who's going to put a lot of stuff on his head again.
Yeah, but that's, I don't know. I mean, do you really think they made that much off of knockoff fezzes?
No, I don't think BBC was the one that made money off of that kind of stuff. It's, you know, all the Etsy shops.
Yeah, that's true. And haberdashers. But then is that really, doesn't that just sort of shoot the whole theory in the foot then of whether or not BBC is considering that as a merchandising push?
I don't know that it's merchandising as much as maybe trying to get back some of that younger audience that they might have lost under Capaldi. And maybe they're the ones that are buying some of this merchandise. I don't know.
Maybe. I don't know. I would think that they, before they made any sort of consensus on that, they have to see how things fare with Bill. I mean, every time you make a subtle change, and it has to be kind of subtle changes. It's kind of like in anything, any sort of project that you're working on, whether it's, you know, whether it's a television program or you're building a car or you're fixing a computer or whatever it is that you're doing that requires, you know, multiple points of failure. You know, if you're trying to fix something or you're trying to improve something, you don't change 10 things at once and then wonder which one worked. You do them iteratively. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and that way you can see, okay, well, we made there's a change of writers. We're going to get to that in a minute. You know, let's see what kind of shift that has. We've obviously got a new showrunner. That's a big change. If you've got the opportunity, it doesn't always have to be a Stephen Moffat clean house, or I should say RTD into Moffat clean house and you know, best of luck, guys. Here's the keys. The light switches are over there on the left wall. So if Chibnall can come into this and say, all right, I've got chess pieces. I'm going to shift and see how things do over the course of, you know, until we get to mid-season, get through the first 2 to 3 production blocks, then start making steering corrections. Mm-hmm. Then again, it's not my call. Who the hell am I? I'm suddenly yutz in New England. New? What's wrong with the old England? So.
Well, but I mean, I've been hearing these rumors now for a couple weeks that, you know, oh, it's going to be Capaldi's last season. Oh, they're going to do a fresh slate when Chibnall takes over. But I haven't seen anything confirmed beyond just wild speculation.
Mm, correct. And I think, well, other than the fact that this plays very similarly to the whole Power of the Daleks thing. When the Mirror put that out there, they were the only source that said so, and everybody echoed them. Mm-hmm. And so everybody's follow-up breaking news was just a rehash of the Mirror's one article that said, sources have told us. So since it still has that layer upon layer of repackaging on one news story that isn't necessarily news, it's just a rumor at the core, I don't really know what opinion to have of it. And it bugs me that it doesn't have something more either definitive or dismissive about it.
Yeah. Because it's easy to see Capaldi stepping out after this season. You know, he's had a fairly good run. Mm-hmm. You can see him stepping aside when his showrunner goes, but we haven't seen anything of Bill. Yeah. So,
but and also the fact that it just conflicted with other stories that we had heard from confirmed sources that had told us, don't worry, everything's not going to get dumped on its head, you know, at Moffat's exit. Moffat just said, I'm going to go out with a great season. I have some plans for some things that are really going to shake people up, shake viewers up. But it wasn't necessarily something where he was, you know, burning the bridge and heading for the hills. Although he did just this past week say that he's not going to write anymore for the show. We'll put this into the news link so you folks can take a look at it. But it was apparently in an interview with the, well, it was speaking to students at Oxford Union. The Radio Times picked up the piece on it, that he feels he has invested enough in the show and that when he steps back from the showrunner's seat, he doesn't even want to write for the program anymore. He feels he's done enough for it and it's now time to completely pass the baton.
I don't know. That I buy.
You do?
I do.
Okay.
Well, it's awfully hard to go back to being a knight after you've been the king.
I guess so. I guess the only thing that's got me kind of curious about it is because of the fact that we know about this whole writer's room discussion. Mm. And if that's going to be the case, he doesn't necessarily have to have the full writer's credits, but they may want him in the room every once in a while to say, by the way, we want to further a storyline or go forward with a character. You know, we waited, we gave a moratorium of 6 to 8 episodes, but we want River back. And River's yours. So we just want you in the room while we're discussing this. Mm. Or, you know, or Jack Harkness. It's never going to happen.
No.
But you know, that kind of a thing. You know, he set so much in motion. We owe a lot over the last, you know, few seasons to what he has crafted from scratch. And he is, you know, we come to his defense all the time. He is an exceptional writer for where his strengths lie. So if that were available to you, I don't know. There's a lot of folks that think, oh, he'll come around. He'll walk away and he'll be, you know, he'll go cold turkey for like a year and a half.
Yeah. If he is going to come back, it's definitely not going to be in Chibnall's first season. I will say that much at least.
Mm. Yeah, see if he sinks or swims. and then come paddling back in. Heard you missed me.
Miss me yet?
I don't know. But yeah, I guess, I don't know. And obviously, you know, well, Digital Spy wanted to kind of tie this in there. Like, so, you know, would this mean that RTD would come back and be able to write a couple of episodes too? Well, I don't know. I will say, Moffat being Moffat, in his most recent interview in Doctor Who magazine, I'm gonna throw this one overhand at you, Haley, because I don't really know what to make of this. It's the female companion argument.
Right. He was saying that Doctor Who's companion should always be female, and his reasoning is not bad. It's that women have historically been underrepresented in science fiction, and mm-hmm. that the companion is very much, at least in modern Who, an iconically female role.
Right. There's something missing, though, from his argument that there is. I think the way he was phrasing it was that you have to have the. You know, he says, you know, Doctor Who itself is inherently about kindness and compassion mm-hmm. and wisdom over violence and those things. And he said, and I'll quote here, from that point of view, it's important that the main character, the Doctor's best friend, should be female. And that's where I scratched my head. Because if it's a matter of saying that you have to have something that sets a tonality of compassion, kindness, of intelligence, intellect over violence and demonstrations of brute strength, then what about a female Doctor, male companion dynamic?
I would be fine with it. You don't have to convince me.
I know. It just seemed like a strange way to put that argument forward and then say, and clearly the only way to do it is with a female companion.
Mm-hmm. Well, and they've, since Rory and Amy left, they've done the single companion in the TARDIS thing. Mm-hmm. And it looks like that's what they're going to be doing next season with Bill and the Doctor. And I wouldn't mind them going back to having, you know, a couple, three people in the TARDIS.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Platonic, please.
Yeah.
You know, every once in a while, have, you know, let Riggsy come back in. You know, maybe Riggsy and Bill are from the same neighborhood, or you know, or have seen each other. They're acquaintances that have never really met, and you know, and he gets bumped along with this every once in a while. Of course, he's got the greater knowledge. It'd be kind of a funny instance insofar as
where the main companion is learning from the temporary companion.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, we've done this. Yeah, yeah. Just be careful. Don't stay around any ravens. Just whatever you do, avoid the blackbirds. But yeah, I don't know. I genuinely think that we're due for a bit of a shakeup, or a bit of a change of format for a little while. Haley, I'm going to go to Elihu again.
Okay.
We sat in that last panel, like almost the last panel of the entire weekend, where we were discussing the Doctor Companion symbiotic relationship. And I know with a lot of the folks that were in the room, we sort of came together with some ideas about what if they just keep it light and comedic mm-hmm. and just have some fun for a while, you know? And granted, we were just talking about how Series 10 was going to play with Capaldi and Bill as maybe a return to Seventh and Ace in that sort of professorial relationship and such. But, you know, if we're talking beyond that point and we say, all right, well, you know, maybe in Series 11 that one or the other decides to tap out under the Chibnall era, beginning of the Chibnall era, there's nothing to say necessarily. I think it would be really interesting if you have a kind of a fresh companion in Bill, who's only been in front of our eyes for 12 episodes or so, mm-hmm. is going to be the connecting thread into a new Doctor, and she's never seen a regeneration, so that adds all
kinda
kinds
like
of
Rose
interest.
If she didn't have that bad wolf baggage as well,
precisely. Which and not having that brings all kinds of new interesting stuff to it as well. So I don't know. I think there's definitely an advantage to keeping to not flipping it all out. And if you're going to, then maybe by that point in her having to deal with this strangeness of regeneration, maybe that, well, Riggsy really wouldn't be any help in that. He's not really privy to that.
Paternoster gang, bring him back.
Cyrus? Yeah. But no, I mean, as far as putting a third in the TARDIS for a while, because maybe it's going to take whoever the, you know, I can't believe we're already talking about the next Doctor. I hate kind of talking about this, but whenever that happens, that the idea of that the existing companion is having such a hard time grasping it, that it requires a third individual to sort of carry things through. Maybe not necessarily a veteran companion or anything of that sort.
I mean, yeah, maybe somebody. We just pick up a second companion halfway through the next season.
Yeah.
So you've got a couple of newbies trying to figure this out.
Just two lost students. Well, we will say, though, that at least we know for Series 10 there is a little bit of awesomosity coming your way, in case you did not see Twitter explode over the course of the past week. We had, I know, towards the close of New York Comic Con, after they did the BBC Takeover Day, Stephen Moffat was walking off stage after the second of the day's Doctor Who panels and dropped something that I think only a few adept listeners picked up on, that he said, you'll be seeing a classic Who writer coming back for New Who for the first time ever. And hypotheses ran wild. And a couple folks did nail it, because they were really hoping that they were going to see, again, more female representation in the writer's room. And damned if you didn't get it. So Rona Monroe coming back after 27 years. She wrote the last episode of Classic Who, if you're not counting the 96 film. So she wrote Survival for the Seventh Doctor and Ace, and will be coming back to write The Eaters of Light as an episode for Series 10. The title, to me, Eaters of Light, that almost sounds like we're dealing with another shadow creature.
Been getting a lot of those lately.
Yeah. Well, it's an endless source of entertainment. Just turn the lights off, you got a new villain. But yeah, so very, very pleased to hear this. People got really excited about that. Say what you will about Survival, I personally thought it was a solid episode. And in fact, I think the dialogue and some of the relationship work between Sylvester and Sophie was brilliant in it. You'll get around to it eventually, Haley. We'll get through the classic rewatch in a couple of dozen years for you to be able to get to these. But we also have, we can also say that that good friend of the cast, writer Jamie Matheson, is going to be coming back. Very pleased on this, because Jamie has given us some great material from Flatline, Mummy and the Orient Express, most recently from The Girl Who Died. So definitely got his balance of comedic and horror chops in there. Yeah, looking forward to that as well. So yeah, and continued news on development for Series 10 will keep coming at us. As we mentioned, they're coming back into their final production block. So going to be real pleased to do that. I think that pretty much covers us for the news. Unless did I miss anything?
There's a little video there at the end that people might be interested in.
If you got 2.5 minutes and you don't mind, if you don't mind trailers, sort of extended trailers, you get almost a completely uninterrupted sequence from The Christmas Story, The Return of Dr. Mysterio, with a temporary American companion, and Nardole, who is not as annoying as I thought he was going to be. I'm prepared. And I love Matt Lucas. I love Little Britain. I love so much that this man has done. I just didn't understand why Nardole was back. So maybe
still
this will help me.
But, you know.
No, but at least he's not wearing the hat anymore.
That's good.
The Cartman hat. but no, it's fun. And it's definitely enjoyable. So get yourself excited, because we're just a little bit over a month away from having some new Who.
Crazy.
Yeah. Oh, my. I've been holding my breath for so long, I'm getting lightheaded. But, yeah. So we'll get ourselves prepared for that one. When we convene next week, we'll dive back into our classic rewatch. But this time, it's a juggernaut. It is the, dare I say, the story to end all stories. It's it is the War Games. 10 episodes giving us an opportunity to see off the end of the Troughton era. So you've got the whole World War One battlefield that suddenly goes very, very awry. Some mind control, hypnotic specs, a John Peel look-alike in General Smythe. We'll get to that all next week. And get this, other Time Lords. What?
Aww.
We haven't even had that yet. But yes, so Malcolm Holm and Terrence Dix penning a great, great story. I know we have a lot of folks that are waiting for us to start reviewing this so that they can chime in. So if you're listening to this now, go ahead and start tweeting us all of your
thoughts. It's a good thing we've got a long holiday coming up.
Yeah, 10 episodes does take a while to get through. Pay attention to characters. That's all I got to say, Haley. Pay attention. Okay. But no, it's a great one. And Wendy and Fraser are absolutely on point through this one. It's just a load of fun. And it's bittersweet too, obviously, because knowing that this is Troughton's last. So, but until we convene, this has been episode 209 of Gallifrey Public Radio. When we see you next week, Jay will be saying something witty. But this is Kier saying, yeah, I'm going to go upstairs and cook myself some zucchini spaghettini because I've had this craving for it all week. I can't understand.
And this is Haley saying, alien invasion or teen angst?
Both smell like something. We'll see you next week.
Bye.
Honestly.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.GunnaGeek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2016.